We'll continue with post-implementation review, and Leonard.
Agenda paper 6 is a summary of the request for information published by the ISP in the end of January. The main objective of this meeting is to get your inputs on this request for information. I would like to try to respond to some of these questions that are included in the request for information. I also provide you a very quick update on the status of the project. If you go to slide 7, you can see that the first phase of the project is finished with the publication of the request for information. In the first phase of the project, we have identified the main issue. We are now in the second phase of the project, and in this phase, we are analyzing this issue. We analyze this issue in two ways. The first way is analyzing the reply to the request for information. The deadline for comment is the end of May. And the other method is a meeting like this. And so in this meeting, we will try to reply to some of these issues. At the end of the phase two, we will report to the ISB our findings, and we will set up the next steps of the project. In the next slide, I will show you the main issue included in the request for information, and I will stop after every slide to get your inputs. The first issue is in slide 9 and refer to the definition of a business. IFRS 3 provides a definition of the term business and provides some guidance in identifying a business. However, we know that sometimes it's difficult to assess whether an acquisition is an acquisition of assets or a business combination. A classical example that was already mentioned is an acquisition of an investment property with associated not significant processes like maintenance, security. Some think that the acquisition of an investment property is a business combination and so should be accounted for in accordance with IFRS 3. Others think that no, this is only an acquisition of an asset and so should be accounted for in accordance with IFRS 4. Our question for you is, what are the difficulties that you are facing now in addressing, in implementing the IFRS 3 guidance on the identification of a business?
We struggle with this. Maybe it's the second bullet in the yellow. There's limited guidance on what is not a business. But it surprised me of how much discussions we get into. We do a lot of intellectual capital acquisitions or intangible asset acquisitions, and I'm surprised when I look at them, I say, this is an asset acquisition, it's a slam dunk. And then we get caught in the actual words of what's a business and what's not a business and have pretty long debates about it. And so I think there needs to be more help is needed in practice, because I'm quite surprised by the number of debates we've had. But to me, as a simple acquisition of assets has been caught up in a business definition.
Sorry, do you have some specific example?
Well, the example would be the acquisition of a patent portfolio. And then it's just, you look at, I'm not sure if you'd say it's a 3 criteria or now a 2 criteria of inputs, processes, and then outputs has kind of, I guess, have been de-emphasized a touch. And it's the issue of do you have the processes in place or you have to go get the processes? And I think there's just too much open debate in that area where it needs to be more specific, that it seems at times almost anything can meet the definition of a business if you want it to meet the definition of a business. And it's a lot of these are just asset purchases. So I can't give you the exact words it needs to be. It needs to be something that needs to be worked on, but it's a problem, I think.
Hey, Bob, everything else being equal, you would prefer something to be viewed as an asset purchase and an acquisition of a business, if assuming there was a choice.
I think so, but I would try to answer that, and maybe this sounds a little naive, but I try to answer that. I'd like to account for it for what it is.
I understand, but what's easier?
Well, I don't know if either is easier, but you know, I would say I'd like to account for it as what it is, and these are definitely asset acquisitions, and I've got to talk about goodwill generation. So maybe answering your question a little bit, but I'm talking about the goodwill calculation for purchase of intangible assets. That's not a business combination. It just seems bizarre to me.
Kevin?
Yeah, I think when the definition changed is what created the crises. So in the mining industry, it was that word capable that killed us. We've bought several dormant companies, which were businesses. These were adjoining properties which had a processing plant. Because they were our adjoining properties, their underlying reserves now became economic to us, and therefore it had activities, the reserve and an asset, the plant, and suddenly we had a business. But we bought the plant because it was more efficient to use the adjoining plant than to truck it to another plant. So we knew what we bought, an asset. We ended up having to do a business combination. Just, you know, it's because it is so precise, the judgment's gone away. All the companies don't seem, in my mind, business. We have two examples.
I mean, I come from a pharmaceutical industry where this is a key issue, and obviously with us, one of the key issues, something you actually haven't raised in your paper, is the unfortunate consequences of accounting for contingent consideration. If you could see yourself doing away with contingent consideration, I think a lot of the debate about whether it's a business or not would disappear. So perhaps you should think about doing away with contingent consideration accounts.
On this point, I also had some discussion with some members of your Pharma Forum. Are you going to come up with some proposals in a formal way, or?
We were certainly going to be submitting some responses, whether they end up being something that you can take on board, we'll have to see. But. The other point is, you know, and I used to have a very old-fashioned view that if we were buying a legal entity, it was an uphill battle not to argue it wasn't a business. Now, many of my colleagues would disagree with that, but you know, be interesting to hear your views. You know, is a legal entity always a business or not? I mean, you could argue a legal entity has more attached to it than just an asset. It's got a whole tax structure attached to it. It's got, you know, there are advantages being a corporate entity as opposed to buying a single asset.
Maria?
I think probably all industries have this issue. We have an issue with the business versus asset, but I think it's just the debate around it is what the issue is. So, and mostly around how many processes have you actually acquired in this and how many activities involved. So you would think that this would not be something you'd spend so much time on. I think we spend too much time debating whether it's a business or an asset purchase, because what we do mostly is you buy a bank or you'll buy a portfolio of assets, but sometimes when you buy this portfolio of assets, which you think is an asset purchase, it comes attached with things, system perhaps, or something like that, which that creates the debate around whether it's an asset purchase or a business purchase. So I would agree with your third bullet. I think it's the processes surrounding, I think the processes that you need to consider, sometimes I think we just back to that splitting the hairs thing that I'm using a lot, but we do send, I think we go down a rabbit hole sometimes unintentionally. I'm sure the standards weren't set for us to be so strict in the interpretation of what we consider based on the definition.
Marie, I have a question. Do you think the tension is around the point that Kevin raised, which is it's prospectively in theory capable of being operated as a business, as opposed to today it's operated as a business and I'm buying it for that reason, Do you think that's the tension?
Yeah, I think maybe, I don't know, I think maybe the conflict is your intention when you buy versus the capability of it in the future. Maybe that's the difference, right? Your intention for buying it wasn't to do what it's already doing, but if you use the definition, it's doing that, right? So you perhaps that's it then becomes the discretion of the person purchasing, that's the problem, right? Your intention is different.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious from Bob's perspective. When I was at the SEC back in the 80s, this was a key issue on a daily basis. Registrants, as you know, would have to file additional financial information if they were acquiring a business as opposed to they were just acquiring assets. The definition of a business is absolutely critical. It triggered a lot of reporting requirements, additional audits. But as I recall, that definition was not as expansive and as broad as it is here in IFRS.
Capable, that's the killer.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually a lot easier to, I think, assess. So I'm just curious whether or not, you know, you're a U.S. registrant, how you compare this definition with what's in U.S. GAAP. To me, this one's harder to avoid. U.S. GAAP's easier to.
Should be the same because it's a converged standard. So this should be.
Converge GAAP, but the definition regulation SX, I'm not sure, and I may be wrong, that's going back 25 more years ago, I think is slightly different.
Yeah, but SX requires them to have been operating, making profits, and
that's
all the
right.
other rubbish.
Well, sounds like they're two different purposes, one for additional disclosures, one for this. Can I just ask a question? There's a lot of debate about what a business is because the accounting's different. I think you alluded, Bob, that you'd rather not have to go looking at goodwill if it was an asset acquisition. But what if the differences, we took the differences away? So that's another approach rather than try to clarify what a business is.
Yeah, it is. And it gets, you know, not peeking forward, but gets them into an issue. And maybe it has to do with the amortization or non-amortization of goodwill or indefinite life intangibles. It's a path. When we get to the question that says, should identifiable intangibles be separated from goodwill? My response is most definitely yes. Just because they're intangible doesn't mean they're not there. But I hear you. There's different ways to attack it.
I think if you take away the accounting arbitrage and say, I'm a proponent that goodwill should be day one debit. If you make goodwill day one debit, all the intangibles will be found. While you've got goodwill as a dangling debit that never gets amortized, there's no incentive for preparers to find the intangibles. There's a huge incentive for them not to find them. Mm-hmm. And sort of, as we're moving, say, off of that original question, on the measurement issue, we had an issue on one of our business combinations with particularly the contingent liabilities.
We
bought an entity which was a business, so it was fine. It had contingent liabilities. We struggled to get those contingent liabilities onto the balance sheet as part of our purchase price allocation, principally for two reasons. One was the audit firm was the same audit firm we had, and therefore they struggled to get onto a page that in one place they're concluding it's a liability and on another page they're concluding it's a contingent liability. And second was because our intention, because we weren't wedded to these litigation issues, was to just settle them as quickly as possible, they analogized them into restructuring provisions and said, well, then you definitely can't, because that's equivalent to a restructuring provision, but it was a known contingent liability that existed pre-acquisition. It was our intention to settle it that was our decision. And it's, you know, there's a tension there as well.
Can I just ask about the contingencies? Because I don't know if you and Malcolm were talking about the same kind of contingency.
I was talking about consideration.
Assets and armed liabilities.
So you were talking about contingent consideration, presumably linked to an earn-out or something?
An earn-out, yeah.
Or payments based on the phase to which, not necessarily on out based on revenues, but based on
registration, success of an in-process project.
Yeah.
I have comment on no amortization of goodwill on page 12. I agree with four comments on this page. I think that most of the issues pointed out on this page will be solved by amortizing goodwill. Under Japanese GAAP, goodwill is amortized. In my view, the benefit of goodwill will generally decrease over time. So under the IFRS and the US GAAP, in case of M&A, the revenue increases and there is no amortization. For generally, the profit increases for several years. And several years later, suddenly, impairment occurs. I think that is not a sound accounting treatment. So I think you should consider the amortization of goodwill.
Should we go step by step?
Okay,
yes. Still up.
The next issue is in slide 10. We can say that the business combination accounting is based on fair value because we recognize the asset acquired and the liability assumed at the acquisition date fair value. However, we have heard so far that sometimes it's difficult to evaluate the fair value of some assets or some liabilities. And so we would like to know to you what are the challenges that you're facing in evaluating at fair value assets acquired and liability assumed. If you have some specific example that you can share with us.
Bob? you have a number of bullet points here. I was going to comment most on the last two. The evaluation practices do vary across jurisdictions. But as you know, there's a move afoot to have maybe one set of internationally accepted evaluation standards. Small, medium-sized companies, it's hard for me to talk about them. I understand valuations are a costly process. I could be a little flippant and maybe I'm somewhat serious on it. And you made a decision first to go public. There's a cost to going public. And you made a decision to make an acquisition. So there's a cost to making an acquisition. You should think about those when you're making the acquisition. I'll hold off on contingent liabilities and contingent consideration. I think others talked about that. We talked about, I will comment on it. We talked about in the original, when the business combination item came out, is, if two companies can't agree on consideration, then how are you going to come up with a fair value of contingent consideration? Now, I know there's a difference, and maybe you need to look at it differently. If there's something based on future sales or something like that versus you just can't agree on the price, I'm not sure if it's easy to do. But quickly, the last two I wanted to talk about. Pre-existing contracts. I understand the theory of it. It's been a big pain for us. Just if you want to get practice issue of our acquisition of Nokia's devices and services business, we had pre-existing contract relationship with them. Went through a huge exercise and came to the conclusion that it was neither favorable or unfavorable. I said we're not going to report anything. I think we knew that in the get-go, but we had to go through a tremendous amount of hoops and valuation to come up with that. So I'm just concerned that maybe it's a theoretically correct answer is just causing issues in practice, and we really need to get that specific. And then the last one, I'll take a different one, is it is difficult to bifurcate compensation from consideration, but it needs to be done, and usually you can figure it out. So it's hard, a lot of discussions, but usually you know what you're doing when you arrange something like that for the shareholders. And if you're trying to retain them, usually if you're, I believe if you're honest with yourself, you can come to the right answer of what's consideration versus compensation, although it's difficult.
Okay, thanks for that. Then let's move to the next.
Okay. The next one in slide 11 is the separate recognition of intangible assets from goodwill. Also in this case, we heard that sometimes it's difficult to recognize, to identify these intangible assets and to evaluate the fair value of these intangible assets. And so some things that sometimes people evaluate a business as a whole, And so they think that we should not require the separate recognition of these intangible assets. We would like to know your view on these FRS 3 requirements.
Okay. I think it's, you're right in determining the value is difficult, but not in determining that there's an intangible asset there. It's the allocation of the value that's the crisis. But because of the accounting benefit from goodwill, as I said earlier, there's the blind eye to the intangible.
That's not necessarily true, because you can have an indefinite life intangible too. So I think that's another one. I think that's more conceptually where you start splitting hairs and the valuation gets a little bit hairy. Our view on the intangible is it does have valuation measurement issues, and it's mainly because you're kind of looking at all the same cash flows that support both your goodwill and various categories of intangibles, and then how deep do you go and how many layers do you put in, and then depending on how you split it, you do have different impairment assessments, but yet you were, your starting point started at the same place, but as you progress it's different. So I think intangibles has intricacies depending on the nature of the business perhaps that you're purchasing, whether it's indefinite life or definite life, in terms of quantification. But sometimes you wonder what's the benefit when it's indefinite life of splitting it out if the accounting...
Isn't the impairment risk higher if you do it?
And perhaps it's the impairment risk that that would be the only reason that you would split it, because you have probably a higher impairment risk perhaps on the intangible.
Other comments?
I think they should be separated. I'm surprised how much goodwill I see in business acquisitions. There's a lot of goodwill going on out there. I understand that's difficult for the assembled workforce, and we'll get to the next issue about non-amortization. And as Kevin said, there, you know, I hope we're not peaking, but it's just human nature to peak, and there's just human nature to identify fewer intangibles, and I think there should be more identification of intangibles. Maybe it's something in practice that needs to be done. But it's, I think, Martin, you were referring to it. It's a double-edged sword, and kind of, I'll just leave this as into our next one. Is one of my worst days at Microsoft was when we took our $6.2 billion goodwill impairment, and it would have been nice to have had to amortize some of that previously. So be careful what you ask for. So.
Other comments on tangibles, goodwill, and Hiroshi?
As I commented, most of the problem is solved by amortization of goodwill. So if goodwill is amortized, most of the program will disappear. That's the program of useful lives.
Okay. Then we go to the next question.
Next one is the non-amortization of goodwill. So if you have other comments on this one,
most important.
And also related to the disclosures, if you have difficulties in preparing the disclosure or impairment test.
I was a supporter of this when it first was mentioned as a possibility way back when we were doing business combinations. I thought there's a possibility that goodwill increases over time, and that it doesn't always decrease or doesn't decrease sequentially. I personally say that's pretty naive, and that the work to do a goodwill impairment test is just unbelievably hard and unbelievably time-consuming. And it really matters then, in international standards, it's the cash generating unit, it's the reporting unit, so it has to do a lot with the way your company management looks at segments and how many tests you've got to do. I was wrong. We should have never gone down this route. It's operationally a nightmare.
Well, Bob, did you find, or maybe I'll ask the question more broadly to the room, one thing I had noticed when I was a preparer is relating goodwill to the assets and operations you bought. It's pretty easy on day one, but if you're an integrated company, you tend to break things up and you're constantly organizing. You know, the gap in the linkage between goodwill and the underlying operations slowly separates. Is that generally a problem in the room? There's a lot of heads nodding here.
I think so, and it may be a little different. I talked about cash generating units for EISB, but especially with reporting units in the U.S. is, although you can be careful, and you, the last thing you want is the accountants telling the chief executive how to run the business and look at the business, but you can really, you know, if you're afraid of a goodwill charge, you can, you know, try and make sure.
Putting aside good, I'm thinking more of the testing for the impairment. I mean, I found that over time, acquisitions tend to get broken up and things go to different parts of the company, and the direct linkage between operations and goodwill quickly gets lost after, say, a few
years. At the date of acquisition, it's difficult to do. So allocating goodwill to the right reporting unit is difficult to do.
I'm seeing nods around the room.
And isn't also the first bullet here really a challenge? Because man, that's what I have seen is, man, you have to come up with a fair value or an amount which is the value of the business. But okay, so that is based on what business people have looked at, looking forward at their planning, at their budgeting, and which is always very optimistic and really not neutral. And I think that is what I see is the main challenge of this kind of goodwill testing. Because it is subjective, and even more subjective, because okay, there's always pressure to business people to come up with more optimistic plans, and that is a basis, because you don't have any other basis if you don't have a market value or fair value to come up with really the recoverable amount of that reporting unit. And I think that is really an issue. We have the same experience that okay, that is very difficult to have an objective amount of really good test against. Okay.
Next. The next one is the measurement of non-controlling interest. Now IFRS 3 requires that any non-controlling interest should be recognized, but and also require two measurement methods for non-controlling interest. The first method is to measure the non-controlling interest at fair value. The other method is to measure the non-controlling interest proportionally to the fair value of the net asset acquired. This is an impact on goodwill, because if you measure non-controlling interest at fair value, you recognize the 100% of goodwill. If you measure non-controlling interest proportionally to the fair value of the acquired net asset, you recognize only a stake of the goodwill. We would like to know what are the difficulties that you are facing in measuring non-controlling interest.
Olivia?
I have not defended the case, but if I had, I would choose the fair value if I am going to make a step acquisition, or I know that the percentage will go up and down, because I prefer to have a complete assets and liability, and because of the way you have to treat it afterwards. And if I was going to stay with my parts and will not expect to change the percentage I have in the company, I will take the other methods, because the risk you have of impairment is higher if the goodwill is higher. And the impact of the impairment goes on the operating results.
I mean, US GAAP doesn't have the option, so that you have to use fair value. So are you in the States getting a lot of pushback?
Not that I'm aware of.
I'd like to make a point, not quite on the NCI, but on the previously held interest. And I think you need to address that too. We had a very interesting situation of having a large previously held equity interest. And then we had to squeeze out the last part of the publicly held company. And of course, to squeeze out the last part, we had to pay an awful lot for those last few shares. And then we had to apply that price for those last few shares, or the big debate was, did we have to apply the price for the last few shares to our minority previously held equity interest? And I think it obviously didn't make sense. We felt there's a unit of account issue. The unit of account of a large block of shares is very different to the unit of, to the value of.
Tell them, Mark.
So we actually, in fact, it's on public record, we had a big battle with the SEC. Finally, they accepted our point of view. But under that was prior to IFRS 13. We understand under IFRS 13, the fair value definition is clearly the fair value of the last few shares that you pay. And we believe that is totally inappropriate.
I agree to that, but maybe we have some discussion because we had a board decision based on that. Okay, do you really, when it's a kind of an investment, okay, bigger part, okay, what is really then the fair value? But it's more than associate subsidiaries, I think, in your case. But okay, there is a debate, okay, is it really the price of the individual financial instrument or is it something different? And I think there will be coming an exposure draft, which be then people can comment on that. I said it because I have a dissenting view, because I think it should be measured differently, because it is something different.
It's very different. If you have a
previously
held equity interest, we had 25% minority stake, couldn't do much. But to value that in the same way as the last few shares that we had to pay a premium on to squeeze out the minority doesn't make any sense.
But you can comment on that, because it will be out soon.
Okay.
Any other comments on the NZI?
The only point I would make, which is not on your slide, but which is a limited amendment to be looked at. Next steps to be determined based on your agenda is the any put options that your non-controlling interest would have and the accounting of that. The day two accounting. At any rate, that was something we've seen a lot of divergence in practice on that accounting treatment. So we're looking with great interest to the agenda as to when that will be reviewed.
Good.
Disclosure. About the disclosure, we would like to know if for you preparing some of the disclosure required from IFRS 3 is particularly difficult. So if you are fine with the disclosure, or if some disclosure for you is particularly difficult to prepare.
Understand the call for additional disclosure. I'll just give you, I'm not sure if this is probably not on point, but it has again to do, since we're in the midst of it, is our acquisition of Nokia's devices and services. And it kind of cracks me up, I guess, in a bad way. Is the big deal now for us is if the acquisition is going to occur at 11:59 p.m. March 31st or 12:01 a.m. on April 1st. That's a big deal to us. If it's done after the quarter end, but before the earnings release, and I believe IFRS is similar, I'm not quite sure, to U.S. GAAP is, you need to provide the disclosures and the pro forma disclosures. It's a lot of work, and just with the rules, you want to think about is if people are thinking about when to actually finalize a business combination, not looking at when the regulatory approvals will come in, you kind of talk to your corp dev people and say don't do one close to the end of a quarter, and that's kind of ridiculous. It's like the accountant's telling the business what to do. The only other one I want to talk about is this organic growth through acquisition-driven growth. Difficult to do. I think it maybe gets to Gary's position that goodwill kind of gets assumed. I'm gonna kill myself for saying this, but maybe you should have us do something in that area, because I've seen enough bad acquisitions in my lifetime to last me forever. Maybe we should be doing more work, even internally, on seeing if acquisitions were actually a good idea or a bad idea. I think economic theory would academic theory, if I can say that, says a large majority of them are bad deals. And I'm not sure if we're just missing it in business, and hate to say that a a disclosure initiative from accountants would change behavior, but maybe it's something we need. Not sure I'm a big proponent of it, but maybe something we need.
Isn't there a link there to our previous discussion about what to do with goodwill as well? I mean, in a sense, if you, you know, for example, if it's a direct debit to equity and you forget it forever afterwards, it's sort of avoiding the accountability problem. Or if you're not doing some sort of impairment test, however difficult it is, or however imperfect it is, then you know, maybe you're losing some of that accountability.
As Peter, the shaking my head because the direct debit to equity is as good as not amortizing because it doesn't impact anybody. You know, if it goes through the P&L, it hits EPS, then it's real. Anything that goes up in equity is not real. Management doesn't care.
Even I don't know what the right answer is, but even net income, we're going to get into the IPR&D shenanigans, which says, come on.
So, you know, you've got to put the pain somewhere. There's to encourage the identification of the intangibles, there has to be pain, but not finding the intangibles.
But I mean, before goodwill non-amortization came in, everybody used to ignore goodwill amortization.
Yeah.
So I don't know that amortization would be the solution either.
No, I think if you can't identify an asset, it's called CEO ego, and that doesn't hit any asset that I recognize. So that's a direct debit to the income statement, exactly the same as a bargain purchase is a direct credit to the income statement. Bargain purchases aren't direct credits to equity, so bad acquisitions shouldn't be direct debits to equity.
But why don't they ignore that as well? Because they won't be able to distinguish the good ones from the bad ones.
Yeah, but the pain has hit the EPS.
Well, they'll just use supplementary.
That's management with all their other non-GAAP measures. But the pain has occurred. You've stood up and said, "This is we've bought something that has no value."
But they won't say that, will they?
Well, the income statement will reflect that. They might adjust, but they
after
will.
The fire, then.
Hiroshi?
Regarding the comment on page 14, there are comments from users. I have an impression they are requesting a little too much. You need to consider the discussion of disclosure initiative. That means that you need to consider both the effectiveness and the efficiency.
I have a question, please.
Any Miro?
I've asked Bob's feelings about the difference between asset acquisitions and business acquisitions. But what is the plan concerning that? Is the idea to explore that the acquisition of assets, whether during the post-implementation review or?
It's a matter of finding out what sort of feedback we do get, but the clear issues are, and the reason I asked the question about gearing the accounting arbitrage is that we have a 93-page paper analysing definition of a business, and it worries me that the more and more detail we go into that, we could create a whole book on definition of a business, and yet the only reason people care is because there's an accounting difference, and I'm interested in understanding whether you think that there should be an accounting difference between those things. In other words, you know, take Bob's example. You buy a whole lot of different patents and things like that, and they are capable of operating independently as a business or in conjunction with your other assets as a business. But how do you think of them? Because the ideas were supposed to be in a business combination was as if you're indifferent about whether you bought a group of assets or you bought them as part of a business. You're trying to get the same starting points. The difference was, at the time of the debate, we very nearly got rid of the difference on acquisition costs, but they decided that since we hadn't exposed it for group of assets under IAS 16, that we probably shouldn't just impose it. But they very nearly did. And of course, that's one difference, deferred tax and goodwill, for example. So we have to see and understand. That's why we've asked one of the questions in there about whether you see there being a sufficiently big difference between a business and a group of assets to warrant different accounting. Now, if the feedback we get is no, then we have a different issue. Because aligning it's one thing, but I think some would rather we aligned it one way or another. So the acquisition cost debate might come up again and so on. So we just have to see what people, we're trying to find out what people say, what A, whether they think it's a problem, and B, what their the general sense of which of the solutions is better to add some colour or redefine a business or to remove the arbitrage.
I think you're right. Remove the arbitrage, but remove it in a sensible way. Get rid of contingent consideration and contingent.
Stop writing contracts like that.
Any other comments on the post implementation review for business combination? Not the case. Same. Thank you, Leonard.